Philip Roth turned 80 years old this week, and his hometown of Newark, New Jersey, a city he left long ago but often returns to in his books, honored the man often acclaimed as America's greatest living novelist, with a marching band and a birthday cake in the shape of books piled high and lots of symposia. The Library of America has just completed the 9th volume of its complete collection of Philip Roth's works, from 1959's Goodbye Columbus to 2010's Nemesis. And next week, PBS will air a film called Philip Roth, Unmasked, as part of its American Mastery series. This week, we spoke with Philip Roth from Manhattan. Happy birthday, Mr. Roth.
Thank you very much.
How did you feel about having the entire city of Newark celebrate your birthday? And beyond Newark, too, to be sure.
Well, no, it was quite wonderful. The hall was full of people, and many of my guys I went to high school were there, and some of the girls I used to take out. It was quite terrific, yeah.
I've read that you've got a post-it note in your apartment in Manhattan that says, "The struggle with writing is over."
Yes, yes, yes.
Is that true, though?
Yep. I didn't know I'd stopped writing, but I began to get the idea. I guess it's about 3 years ago that I finished a book called Nemesis. I didn't know it would be my last book, but I was months trying to start something new, and I wasn't having any success. And then it occurred to me I didn't have to do this anymore. I've been doing it since about 1955, when I was 22 or 3. And so I gradually stopped writing. And found that it was very pleasant. And indeed, I haven't written for several years now.
Does that mean you've ceased to look at life and think, no, there's something worth writing about? There's something in there that's a story or a character or an image?
Yep, that's exactly what it means. it's more likely it happens that someone tells me a story. And in the old days, I would immediately begin to think about it, you know, if it was an interesting story. And think what's in there, you know. And I would go home and make notes and keep it, play with it and toy with it, and it was a constant mental activity, really. And now I just listen, and it's quite nice. I go home and go to sleep.
Do you feel like there's something's been lifted from your shoulders?
Or? Very much so. But it's you know, there are many jobs that are hard. This is one of them. I don't know any writer for whom it comes easily. Maybe John Updike. A story would just seem to come to him whole, you know, out of a personal experience. But the rest of us, I think, are not so lucky, and I had to work hard, yeah.
How did the attention and success of Portnoy's Complaint in 1969 change your life?
Drastically changed my life. I suppose the most fundamental way is I had some money for the first time in my life. Then it also produced a good deal of fame and notoriety, both. Not that everybody stopped me on the street, but during the months when the book was on the bestseller list and it was so notorious for being such a dirty book, a lot of people took it upon themselves to talk to me on the street. They would sometimes shout from automobiles. They'd say, "Hey, Portnoy, leave it alone." And I was the butt of these jokes. And it's okay. It's all part of it, you know. But eventually, I didn't really want that much of that, and so I moved to the country.
Let me ask you about Nathan Zuckerman, who I guess has appeared in 9 of your novels.
Mm-hmm.
What's kept you two together?
He's useful. He was a useful instrument for me. His mind was useful to me. He was the mediating intelligence in a lot of books. He would... By which I mean he was a smart narrator.
And how wise is it for people to assume that you and Nathan Zuckerman are more or less the same person?
I think it's unwise, but I can't seem to do anything about it. You know, you of course you bank on your experience, but as a sounding board. It isn't that you write down what happens to you every day. You wouldn't be a writer if you did that. But it gives you a sense of, you know, from your experience what life is like. Mm-hmm. And you weigh what you invent against your sense of actuality. So sometimes something that happened to you is of interest, but I would say that 80% of the time it's something that happened to somebody else that's of interest.
There's a man, I believe, named Blake Bailey, who's your biographer.
Mm-hmm.
Are you helping him out?
You bet. That's what the writing I do now is for him.
Yeah.
I think I... work at least a couple hours a day answering his questions.
Well, how do you feel about him certainly making the attempt to get into the most private moments of your life?
Well, that's part of the deal, you know? That's the deal you accept. There aren't that many secrets. Do you have big secrets? I don't really have any.
I gather that the Library of America started to publish what they consider to be the definitive edition of your work 10 years ago. And then you maybe surprised them by just bringing out not only new novels, but some of your best while you were in your 70s.
I just kept doing what I was doing. I have energy, you know, and I'm fairly fit. And I am dedicated to this thing. Mm-hmm. I was devoted to it all my life. That was my great problem to solve, how to write a book, you know. And after you write one, you have to write another to prove to yourself you can do it again. So my 70s were really not unlike my 60s and my 50s. The only rough time I had was back in the 60s. And mm-hmm. It wasn't just because my life was difficult. I was starting out, really. And I didn't know what kind of writer I was. I wrote one book, Goodbye Columbus, and that was one kind of book. And then I wrote a big tome called Letting Go. I was a big, serious novel. I wanted to write a big novel. And that was an entirely different voice. Mm-hmm. And When She Was Good was a third kind of voice, and Portland Complaint was a fourth kind. I didn't know what my voice was, you know. So the first 10 or 15 years, you're making your way into your kind of literature, which you do not know about beforehand. I think by the time, and you make many false starts, as I did in those years. I have half novels and truncated novels and so on. But as time goes by, I think I became a bit more certain about what my territory was and how I sounded. And in truth, I don't know what happened in my 70s. My breakfast cereal remained the same.
As I don't have to tell you, there's some women readers who say that they felt uncomfortable about some of your work.
Yeah.
Charging too many of your women characters seemed to be unsympathetically drawn and cardboard.
Those are reckless generalizations and don't show a great deal of astuteness in the reader.
So the problem is in their reading, you think?
Absolutely. Without a doubt.
A book with your name on it, I could be contradicted on this, but, you know, it would be received with respect, and you'd write another one after that. But when you were just starting out, as you've said, it was harder to know if you could make a life as a novelist. And I just wonder if what happens when you become more successful as a novelist.
You know, the job is no less difficult. The job is exactly the same. As I said in the beginning, you have a certain set of problems having to do with being a kind of amateur. But it doesn't get any easier. Solving the problem of the book you're writing always remains hard work. Mm-hmm. And your progress is snail-like. Even if you write a book in 2 years, sometimes you get a page a day. Sometimes you get no pages. You might maybe write 3 pages, you throw them away. Every sentence raises a problem. And essentially what you're doing is connecting one sentence to the next, you know. Mm-hmm. And you write a sentence, and you have to figure what comes next or what doesn't come next.
Is there, I'm not going to list all the prizes you've won over the years, but I wonder if there's any kind of recognition left that would mean something to you now.
Well, I've gotten a lot of them, and it's probably enough. And it ceases to have real impact. Some mean a great deal to you, you know. Mm-hmm. And when the prize befalls a certain book that you like particularly, it's wonderful, you know. But look, the receiving a prize excites the child in you, and then you go back to work the next day.
Is there something you're taking more time for now? That
well, yeah, naps. Let me tell you about the nap. It's absolutely fantastic. When I was a kid, my father was always trying to tell me how to be a man, and he said to me, I was maybe 9, he said, Philip, whenever you take a nap, take your clothes off and put a blanket over, and you're going to sleep better. Well, as with everything, he was right. And so I now do that, and I come back from the swimming pool I go to, and I have my lunch, and I read the paper, And I take this glorious thing called a nap. And then the best part of it is that when you wake up, for the first 15 seconds, you have no idea where you are. You're just alive. That's all you know. And it's bliss. It's absolute bliss. So I suggest you're still working, but your time will come.
That sounds like great advice.
And take your clothes off.
Mr. Roth, a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Philip Roth, the Library of America, has completed its 9-volume publication of the definitive edition of his books, from 1959's Goodbye Columbus to 2010's Nemesis. That's more than half a century of work. And next week, PBS will air the documentary Philip Roth, Unmasked, as part of its American Masters series. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.